VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. Yes, I'm back and I'm really, really sorry. I feel like I need to apologize on behalf of News Corp for last week. I was away, of course, on another continent, and unfortunately, Allison Rudd could not step in. I know it was rough with Max Rushton, but he does his best. And look, it's okay to be different. Nothing wrong with that. But the good news is Allison Rudd is back with us this week. And Allison, you're going to be filling in for me next week too, right?
That's the rumor.
That is exciting. That is exciting. That's fantastic. Maybe you'll have Max on as a guest.
I do hope so. I can show him how it's done.
Exactly. Exactly. He doesn't have too much experience in radio and television after all. Also joining us, it's Tony Cascarino. And from the lovely hamlet of Didsbury, home to one Rory K. Smith. I have never been to Didsbury myself, but they tell me it's leafy and posh. Somebody who I'm guessing would rather not be living there. Is that right, Paul Hurst?
No, I love it here. The gates keep all the commoners out. So, yeah, it's very well protected and lovely. Yeah, it's very nice.
But are you one of those posh Yorkshiremen like Rory and Ben Machel?
I try to pretend that I'm not. I'm actually putting this accent on right now just to sound a bit more working class. I'm part of a middle class hub here in Didsbury. I feel very honoured to be part of it.
Speaking of middle class, later on we're going to be joined by Matthew Syed as well, who is going to be talking some Saido Berahino. There's tons to discuss, but we're going to be starting at Stamford Bridge. Cass, I'm going to begin with you, since you actually played for Chelsea. Going into the Chelsea's two games against Liverpool and Arsenal, I had a chance to speak to somebody close to Conte, and he kind of said, you know what, the worst thing that happens is if we get 2 points out of these two games, we'll still have a six-point lead. They got 4 points out of it. They got the draw at Liverpool, of course, and then this absolute beatdown. They have to feel pretty good about themselves, right?
Yeah, great week for Chelsea. Conte showed in the two games how tactically astute he is, because they go to Anfield, they deny Liverpool. And I thought Liverpool were okay on the night. They didn't quite reach the heights of the early part of the season, but Chelsea really had them covered in most areas. They knew where the problem was going to be. It was going to be from the central midfield area. Done it brilliantly. And I sort of felt against Arsenal, if Arsenal went with the same formation of the three up front with Walcott, Sanchez, and whether it was going to be Iwobi or Ozil, I just thought they had much more running power, Chelsea. They would drive them in many areas, especially out wide. And I thought it was one-way traffic for most ways. And to be honest, Gab, I didn't think it was a game after 20 minutes. And as much as they lost 3-0 at the Emirates, I thought Chelsea absolutely just ruined them physically. And that's what Arsenal can't match. They can't match that physicality of a team that is so dogged. In central midfield areas, it was a non-contest. I didn't quite get why Oxlade-Chamberlain was in that midfield area.
Well, okay, I was going to save that for later, but I will bring that up, and I'll play Wenger defender here unless anybody wants to step in for me. And I kind of felt like, if you're Wenger, what are you supposed to do? Mohamed Elneny is playing in the African Cup of Nations final, so he's not there. Santi Cazorla is injured, of course. He's not there. Granit Xhaka suspended. Aaron Ramsey was injured.
Yeah, he was.
Somebody's got to step into central midfield, right? And play with Coughlin. Oxlade-Chamberlain is really your only option unless you're going to revolutionize everything. And I don't think he was a good fit because you know that Chelsea don't particularly need to win. They can play on the break. So it makes such a difference if you have a passer in that two in front of the back four. He went with Oxlade-Chamberlain. It was the best option he had. What's he supposed to do?
Well, I would say the Ox isn't great defensively. I don't.
That's great. But who? Like,
well, Gab,
you've got four guys who are better than him in that position who are all out. So
well, yes, but
you go to the next in line.
You can alternate your team. You can find a different way. I talked about the front line before the game, and I said if he was to play Welbeck and Sanchez, or Giroud and Sanchez, down the middle, it gives something different for Chelsea to think about. Now, I watched
4-4-2, you mean?
Go 4-4-2. Try something different. Now, as much as you might think, absolutely no chance, would you go, tell you what, let's go and stick Gabriel in midfield alongside Coquelin, because they've got Matic and they've got Kante, who are both high energy and both are very good at defending, stopping and spoiling the play. OK, I don't see, on a regular basis, that being a solution, but it looked one game, I was thinking, I'd rather play Gabriel there than right back, because at right back he can get absolutely ruined, like we saw in the game against midweek. But I would want someone with physical attributes to take on what Chelsea's engine
was. You wanted them to think outside. I mean, I don't think it's a bad shout. I just thought they were so overmatched on paper when you're playing Oxlade-Chamberlain there. Maybe it wouldn't have been great. What do you think of the Cascarino solution?
Well, before the game, I wrote a piece saying just as Conte reacted very quickly to being outclassed by Arsenal in September, and right after half time, he went to three at the back, and that doesn't happen very often. I know it's fairly rare for a manager to change the system that way, but I said following midweek embarrassment for Arsenal, maybe this is the time for Wenger to go to Stamford Bridge and surprise people with his ability to see Chelsea are on a possession to the title. What can you do to interrupt it? What can you do to surprise people? You're absolutely right, Gab. He had very few midfield options, but he's still got quite a lot of depth there to meddle with. And why didn't he go through at the back? Why not do something that makes people think Wenger's actually not stuck in his ways? He's actually analysed this fixture and he's worked out a way to give Chelsea something to think about. I think probably the most annoying thing about the Arsenal performance was they did not give Chelsea anything to worry about. You can't be Arsenal, go to Stamford Bridge and say, well, we'll just try and do our best, do a little bit. It felt very insipid.
Paul, my difficulty with Arsenal on the back of what Alison says is I absolutely hate it when people go and they turn metaphysical to explain sort of shortcomings, and they say, well, they lack bottle, they lack fight, blah, blah, blah. Their pans, these are going to fold. They've got three players in their match day squad with double-barreled last names, which is not a good thing. But I kind of feel that between this and the Watford game, that's kind of a logical explanation. Can you help me give me a more rational reason about why Arsenal are kind of imploding a little bit, without mentioning the B word?
Alison talked there about the depth of the squad. And if you look at someone like Coquelin coming in, who was supposed to be, he was the answer to the problem they've had in defensive midfield a few years ago, and they've obviously, that didn't work, so they've brought Xhaka since. And I just think he kind of symbolised on Saturday what Arsenal's problems are in terms of their squad. He was so flaky, the flick to nowhere that led to Hazard's goal just kind of summed him up, really. And then his feeble attempt at trying to get the ball off this guy who is a lot smaller than him. He couldn't get the ball off him, shrugged him off him. I just think over the last couple of weeks we've seen how weak they are defensively. Mustafi was also supposed to be another, the answer to their defensive problems, but he's looked very weak. You wouldn't have been surprised if you'd been told that Arsenal beforehand, that Arsenal would lose at home to Watford and lose quite easily to Chelsea. I don't think anyone was surprised at how poor they were in those two games.
I'll hold my hand up. I thought Mustafi was a good signing, and I thought the Mustafi-Koscielny partnership would be really good. I've said it here. And I think they can be good when they've got sort of a rational, settled group around them. When they've got Oxlade-Chamberlain and Coquelin playing like that, maybe less so. But I wanted to ask you just sort of mechanically, Cass, and I appreciate you probably haven't been the chasing, holding midfielder many times in your career. But that Hazard goal, which I thought was tremendous, because he beats Koscielny, then there's that bizarre Coughlin thing, and then he beats Koscielny and Mustafi again, and then he scores. The weird Coughlin pirouette amongst himself. Can you explain how it is? Because obviously Hazard is squat and strong for a guy his size. But how does that happen? Did Coughlin just lose his coordination? Was his footwork wrong? Or
well, when
he just looked terrible.
Yeah, well, he makes two attempts, doesn't he? The first attempt, he doesn't really. He gets sort of pushed off quite easy. And the second attempt, he nearly catches an arm from Hazard. Look, he's a pocket dynamo. And when you get close to someone like that and you're running, you're stretching, you're slightly off balance, where Hazard is fixed to his position and he's running towards the goal. And he just can't manoeuvre Hazard at all. Because he's like a little... I mean, as much as we love his pace and his ability to run at people, his upper body strength kept Coquelin at bay. That is something that most players can't do, because the way that Hazard is made, he's a low centre of gravity. You're going to have to shift him off the ball. You're going to have to take a hell of a lot, because he's so strong as well.
Well, he's so fast, though. Can you not just... I mean, again, hindsight being 20-20. With hindsight, Coquelin, he should have just tripped him.
Once you're stretching, Gab, you're off balance.
Well, that's fine. But once you're running so fast, it only takes a touch to bring you down. Was it weird that he didn't foul him? I mean...
I think he tried, Gab. He just couldn't, because he's stretching.
I just thought that was remarkable. Another incident, and we'll turn to a qualified referee. Marcos Alonso and the elbow on Hector Bellerin. Wenger, absolutely adamant, 100%. That's a foul. Conte said no, especially not in England. Who's right?
The referee was right.
And Antonio Conte, by extension.
Indeed. Well, I mean, come on, let's not trust the managers in these situations. They're going to say what they have to say.
Was this Wenger deflecting, or like wearing the Wenger glasses?
I don't know. If it's your player, your team, you're in charge, you probably see it filtered that way, to be honest. But I think me and Tony agree completely on this. If you're going to challenge for the ball in the penalty area, you cannot do that unless you use your arms. And it's up to the referee to decide if the player is trying to gain an unfair advantage by using his arm to elbow a player's head. But the trouble is with this incident, because there's lots of rolling around and dazedness, it looks like it must have been a dreadful, dreadful challenge. But you can't take the consequences and then work backwards and say, oh, it must have been a foul because it looked awful afterwards. It's a tough, feisty attempt to get the ball. It is not illegal.
Hey, Cass, you addressed this in the game on Monday, and to me it looked like Alonso's eyes are fixed on the ball.
Yep.
He just wants to head it. He needs to jump as high as he can to get it. It looked to me like Bellerin, who's obviously a lot shorter, he's a small man, runs into him to try to challenge him and takes the elbow. But is that kind of what happened? And I'm assuming you've in your career, you've had a few stray elbows as well, but you can tell when somebody's trying to whack someone and when they're...
Well, I've probably had in my career that type of challenge more than 100 times. Now, Bellerin's going slightly sideways and backwards, which obviously he can't get much height on jumping. You try jump backwards, you can't never get as much height jumping forward. Alonso is running forward. So the challenge looks worse because Alonso is running onto the ball. He's totally fixed on it and he outjumps him by more than a foot or so. With that, his arms catch his face. But it's not an elbow. It's not a deliberate attempt for me of a foul. So I think Bellerin's got himself in a bad position. He's going backwards. Alonso fixed on the ball. And there's only going to be one winner. Now, the reason why Bellerin's trying to get underneath Alonso, he's trying to keep running backwards. If you keep going backwards...
So you can put him off.
Yeah, you can't... If you're in the air and someone's backing into you, you can't get the power on your header. So I think he's tried, but he hasn't quite got enough. If another yard, I don't think Alonso gets the power on his header. But he's totally fixed on the ball, Gab. If you want to stop this type of goal, stop heading in the game. Because to me, that's a perfectly legitimate goal.
Maybe that's something we should consider and limit the head injuries as well. Maybe not. Paul, I want to ask you about Marcos Alonso, because when you've got players who've been in England before, like we sort of form a verdict, then they go away, and then it's like we think it's the same guy. And so if he comes back, well, he wasn't that good for Sunderland. When in fact, I thought he was pretty good on a bad Sunderland team. But okay, so he's not Roberto Carlos, but he's good in the air. He has a tremendous, tremendous left-footed delivery. And in one-on-one situations, while he's maybe not a speedster, he can certainly jockey his opponent and defend well. And yet there's all this general assumption that Alonso's just some kind of weirdo stopgap. But what's your take? Is he actually much better than people realize?
I think he is, yeah. I think often, quite often when you see teams play 3-5-2, we've certainly seen this with Manchester City this season, is that the opposition team will always try and pick the hole in behind the wing-backs to try and pin them back, you know, to get when, especially on the counter-attack. But with Chelsea, you just don't really see that often because he works so hard that he's got it in his locker to kind of cover both bases, to be a full-back and a winger, which is obviously, you know, what a wing-back is supposed to do. And it's the same with Moses on the other side. I mean, those two are really, you know, two of the, you know, the revelations of the season.
Obligatory Wither Wenger point. What happened?
He said on Friday, I went to his press conference on Friday, we were pressing him on his contract because there's all, it feeds on itself, doesn't it? If you don't know if he's staying or not, what impact does that have on the players and the club's ability to attract players and whether they'll sign the star players to extended contracts? And he just said, it's not quantitative. It's my gut feeling, he said, whether I sign or not, which tells you everything. It means it's entirely up to him. The board will have him if he wants to stay. He brings them top four every season, and that's financial stability. They love him. And that feeds on Wenger, the parallels there. Wenger is the same with his players. You don't ever feel he's prepared to mix things up, drop people, really yell at them, make them scared. There's this sense of it just being too nice and comfortable.
It's a comfort zone club from the top. From the board to the owner to the manager to the players. Players are at Arsenal Football Club now. Maybe will sign contracts. Now, what sort of... I don't get that. If you're a manager of strength and power, you say to Sanchez or Anoza, whoever, if they want to prepare to be the future of the club, you make them make a decision. You don't sit there thinking, well, maybe they'll sign them. If we offer them as great as we can, or we'll break the... I find all that... every situation at the club feels to me wrong.
On the contract front, though, I kind of think Arsenal are playing this correctly. I don't know how much of a market Ozil and Sanchez. I mean, from what we know, there's a big contract offer on the table. I don't know who's going to beat that. I don't know that there's this tremendous market for Ozil and Sanchez where they would move on and go to bigger clubs.
I agree with you on one. I do think that Sanchez would have far more options than Ozil.
Where could he go?
Well, there's always places you can go, Gab. That's.
I mean, are Bayern Munich going to pay him more than 200 grand a week?
I don't.
You're not going to go back to Barcelona. No. I think we can rule out Real Madrid for obvious reasons.
Would you not consider another Premier League team who would match at least what he's getting?
You know, I thought of this, and frankly, other than United, and I'm not saying, you know, what teams could he fit in and make them better, but I don't think he's a fit at City. Plus, they've got tons of players in those positions already. At Liverpool and Spurs, you don't see them going and pushing the boat out that far. I don't think he would fit Chelsea, at least with his scheme, as long as Hazard's around and whatnot. So I don't mind Arsenal saying, like, listen, like, you got a good thing going on here. If you want to make more money, I dare you. I double dare you to go to China. Paul, I'll give you the last word on Wenger and contracts and all that good stuff.
I think if you're on the Arsenal board, they're in love with Wenger. They won't usher him out of the door. But they're also, if I was them, I'd have in my mind what happened at Manchester United as well. I'd think that, you know, after Fergie left, there was, you know, 3 years of underwhelming football and very poor performances in the league.
And a lot of money spent, which Arsenal's owners won't like.
Exactly. And I thought originally that Klopp would have been a perfect fit for them, and they've obviously missed the boat. But yeah, the 3 years of instability that followed, well, the instability that continues to exist at Manchester United will have put Arsenal off making that decision. And they're not a very decisive board. They just let Wenger rule the roost ever since he arrived there. So they're not willing to make a decision to cut ties with him. And it's basically up to Arsene, and, you know, Arsene does what Arsene wants.
Right, moving on to Hull and Liverpool. You kind of don't know what to say about Liverpool and their start to 2017, other than the fact that it's been absolutely horrendous. Let's start with Hull City and Marco Silva. Paul, there was a perception, obviously, among some people, and there's a great, by the way, Football 365, there's this thing called Media Watch, where they go and make fun of people in the media. This fantastic one, just absolutely ripping Cascarino's mates for mocking Marco Silva and, you know, blocking the pathway of another brilliant manager because Marco Silva doesn't know the Premier League and whatever. It's funny. We don't need to go and cover that ground. But they've brought in a ton of new players, most of them guys who nobody wanted, like Umar Nias and Andrea Ranocchia and whatnot. But the sort of mini revival sort of predates the new signings, right?
They've got a lot of other decent players in that squad. You look at the young winger, Josh Time, and he's started out playing out left back, then he went up to left wing. I think he was playing just behind the striker against...
Because I was curious about this guy, Time, because I'm like... Because obviously earlier this year when they had their injury crisis, you know, and it seemed like, oh, poor Mike Phelan's only got five guys, and that's only if you count Tom Huddleston twice because he's big. But is he somebody who maybe was overlooked a little?
I think he's playing more under Silva. He's only 17, so, you know, you can understand why Phelan was a bit more reluctant to give him a go. He's a very focused guy, Silva. I've probably, you know, had unrealistic expectations of him, because I thought, you know, he's a friend of Mourinho, or Mourinho says he's a friend of his, and I expected this big kind of grandstanding kind of manager, but he's very withdrawn, he keeps his opinions to himself, and he just seems to be getting on with it. I know that's a bit of a cliche, but he's got them playing well, playing attractive football.
What's he doing differently, though, from what you can tell?
On the training ground, he's got them training more. We know that he's cancelled days off. He's got them in, you know, more days in the week. So he's drilling them a lot more, which you need to do if you bring seven new players in. You need to make sure they're aware of what he's trying to do, and he's given them confidence as well. You look at the way that Nias took that goal. You would have never expected that from him during his Everton days. Just the way he cushioned the ball with the outside of the foot as he went through, and then, you know, he decided to nutmeg the goalkeeper rather than... There's a big gap either side of him, but he decided to nutmeg him. Just to, you know, because he knew that he could, and it was a great goal to see.
Cass, you've played for some bad teams at times when there's been a managerial change. Can you provide someone? What do you see in this guy?
Coach, knowledge of football. He brings in five players in January from Olympiacos, Inter, Villarreal, Liverpool reserves in Markovic,
Ren.
Nias, you know, from Everton under 23s, knows what he wants, prepared to let players go. We've got to remember, he's let players go as well. You know, he's lost his top goal scorer in Snodgrass and Livermore. So he's lost players, but he's recognised what he's needed. They've beaten Liverpool 2-0 and they've gone to Old Trafford and not conceded. So that's telling you, at the coaching guide manual, he knows how to set up a team.
Completely, completely. What I find remarkable, though, about the guys he's recruited is that Umar Nias didn't score in all of 2016. And if you actually look at his career before that, he had half a good season in Russia. And, you know, and it's not like he's 19 years old. He's 25, 26, I think, at this stage. And he's obviously somebody whose confidence you would think would be totally shot given the situation with Koeman. He brought in Ranocchia, who is the epitome of a guy who's been absolutely destroyed and put through the ringer, a guy who at 21 was supposed to be the next big thing. And then kind of for like a ton of years afterwards was frankly terrible and the butt of jokes. And it was painful to watch this guy. And then he steps in, and with Ranocchia on the pitch, they haven't actually conceded. I put it this way: if you think of it in terms of like the old stereotypes that we throw around, and oh, relegation dogfight, I need tough-minded warriors. These are not the people you would pick, nor would you pick Kamil Grzycki, frankly. Not a bad player, but, you know, not exactly what you would think of. Or, as we would say, you know, a 17-year-old Josh Timon. That's what I find absolutely mystifying.
Fair play to the coach.
All this is going on while there's protests against the owners, and, you know, fans aren't turning up. They've got this ridiculous situation where fans are being asked to buy membership cards rather than season tickets, where there's no concessions for OAPs or for children. That's why the fans are staying away. You know, he's kind of shut himself off.
Sure, can you explain this a little more?
The Alam family in the summer made this, quite frankly, ridiculous change to the ticketing system, whereby you now pay a monthly membership fee to the club rather than a season ticket. And it's the same price across the board. You know, if you are a 30-something professional, you will benefit from this because your price will either, you know, go down or is more or less level to what you were paying before. But if you are, you know, if you're a 60-odd-year-old bloke who's on a pension, I think it's £30 a month, so £360 a year, and that's an increase on what they were paying before. And it's the same for kids as well. So that's what, you know, you can understand why people are staying away. I went to the second leg of the League Cup semi-final, and there was only 16,000 there. 3,000 or 4,000 of those were Manchester United fans. And that was, you know, a huge occasion, a cup semi-final, and people staying away. One tier of the stand was shut.
Obviously, we should talk about Liverpool because people here, I'm sure,
have... Do we have to?
Well, let's start with Mr. Mignolet. It's funny because I made a ranking a few years ago for ESPN about sort of, you know, good signings, bad signings, and I got into this enormous discussion with this guy who's like a math PhD of some kind. He's a super clever guy, but he arguing that Mignolet was actually one of the top five goalkeepers in the world and blah, 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 and he was as good as Courtois. And I don't understand what this guy's problem is, because sometimes he looks good, sometimes he looks terrible. Everybody, you know, went and had a go at Karius. Hit the little diatribe with Gary Neville. And I'll ask you, Alison, do you want Loris back? Do you want
it's interesting you're starting with Mignolet, because I don't think that is currently the biggest problem Liverpool have. It is a problem that Liverpool
He gives up a stupid goal, and then they score a second goal on the counterattack. If he doesn't make that mistake, there is no first goal.
Yeah, but they got a point against Chelsea because he pulled off one of the best penalty saves of the season.
Is there such a thing as a penalty save,
yes,
or is it actually
a
penalty miss?
That's the point. In that case, it was a save. Usually it's a miss. Old days, in the olden times, keepers would do this. They would do something brilliant one week and then they'd make a gaffe the next. And the art of goalkeeping has progressed enormously. So now we have these super keepers who just seem to only make one mistake per season as opposed to one per month or once every 3 weeks. And Mignolet's of that old-fashioned sort. But I think overall, he has, because of his age perhaps, I don't know, I would still stick with him over Karius.
Bigger problems than Mignolet.
I'm not saying it's not a problem. I'm saying with Mignolet, yeah. because there are loads of problems.
Okay.
One of the problems is, let's just get this one out the way now, because it's the one that's annoying me the most, is after the game, Klopp said, even though at this moment it feels really bad, it's not the biggest problem in the world. He says that, or words to that effect, every time Liverpool draw or lose. And at first, everyone thought, oh, how refreshing. Because he's right, isn't it? It's only a football match. The point is, the managers who do really, really well, and Liverpool should be doing really, really well, they don't say things like that. It might be cute and eccentric and refreshing, yes, but I honestly think there comes a point where if you say it after every single time there's a mistake, you're thinking, hang on, what sort of message is that giving the players? He says he was angry at half time, and then at the end he says that. He's sort of saying, oh, it'll be okay eventually. Let's not get too upset.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Everybody.
You asked one question there. What is the biggest problem with Liverpool? Now, first of all, the goalkeeping situation. He doesn't particularly favour either of them, does he, really? He dropped Mignolet and he's dropped Karius. So he doesn't really fancy his number one. He's got two strikers he doesn't really fancy either. But the thing that's masked everything about Liverpool, it's been how brilliant their midfield is. Their midfield got them out of so much trouble during the season, the early part of the season. Goals from everywhere, created so many problems for the opposition. Now that midfield was pretty much, I don't like the word invisible, but they just didn't show up compared to what they were.
Are
now,
they tired? I looked at Lallana and he looked another guy relative to what he was doing a couple of months ago. Yeah.
Well, I would go, Coutinho obviously coming back from injury, he hasn't quite hit the right ground. We've had Mane go away, we've had Lallana looking tired, Henderson, you looked at a hole in the midfield. Emre Can, struggling. So the whole engine room of Liverpool, which won them games, because no other area of the pitch, they haven't got two goal scorers up front or one individual up front who scores loads and loads of goals. Their whole idea of their game plan was midfield players winning them games. Firmino, gone off a bit. Nowhere near where he was. So they've had a whole host of players, from midfielders to offensive midfielders, that have caused a bigger problem. Because now when they're not scoring, Hull City might take advantage of a mediocre goalkeeper. Because that goal typified Mignolet for me. And Alisson's right, there's good and bad days, but you can't challenge and have a good and bad day goalkeeper. You can't win things.
Paul, you're not a Liverpool fan, as far as I know. To me, it seems that maybe the style of play, which is physically demanding, might have a lot to do with it. But then I look at the flip side and I say, these guys don't play Champions League football and they haven't actually played that many games. I think it was 6 games fewer than they did last season at this stage. Is the physical side, is that an acceptable excuse?
I think, having spent a lot of time in Jose Mourinho's company this season, he's always keen to point out the fact that Liverpool do not have any European commitments and therefore should be a lot fresher. The intense game that Klopp plays is bound to have an effect on the team. And at Dortmund, he obviously, when it came to winter time, there was a winter break for his players to relax and you have a couple of weeks off and recharge their batteries. But, you know, it's not been the case here. I know he bought Karius in the summer, but when Joe Hart was available, I don't think City would have had any objections to him joining Liverpool. I just don't see why they didn't take a chance on him. Was it even a chance on taking Joe Hart? He was there, he was available. He wouldn't have cost them that much. They could have taken him on loan. And he just seems far more assured than the Mignolet has been, certainly over the last couple of weeks.
Isn't the explanation in that Joe Hart on the ball with his feet isn't the great? I mean, the same reason I think Pep wasn't so into him. But I think that's a good point. I want to wrap this up with one question. In our piece, and I don't recall who actually wrote it, on Liverpool's issues this year in the game, they point out that in past years, they could kind of revamp and reinvest by selling a prize asset. They did it with Suarez, they did it with Raheem Sterling, and that, you know, maybe there isn't somebody like that now, but in some ways there is. And I think the elephant in the room is Daniel Sturridge. I suggested earlier this year that if Sturridge wasn't going to play, you should maybe sell him while you can and get some money and get guys that Klopp likes. Is this something where now they do have a director of football, the Klopp should be asking himself, all right, I either get this guy on the pitch and figure out how to play with him so that he can contribute to the team, or I need to think about selling him and maybe selling him now because every week that passes, his value presumably goes down. Is that even something Liverpool should contemplate, selling Sturridge?
Well, you said earlier, Gab, that you didn't think there were that many tutors for Sanchez. So how many do you think there would be for Sturridge?
I think there'd be many more. And I think the reason is Sturridge isn't on Sanchez type money. Sturridge is English, and I think that matters as well. With the TV contract, I'll give you a scenario. Okay, I mean, this is just an example. I'm not saying they're going to sell it to Everton, but if Everton sell Lukaku in the summer, right, and they'll get a big £90 million wad of money, you could probably trick them into spending £30-40 million on Sturridge. I mean, we are talking about a guy who, when he plays, he scores a ton of goals.
Do you really think there'll be a suitor for 30, 40 million for Daniel Sturridge at the moment? English clubs, eh? Do you really think there is?
It might not be a top six side. If Harry Kane leaves, maybe you can look at, if we look at the history, I mean, look, they sold Benteke for a ton of money. You don't think you could get Benteke type money for Sturridge?
I don't think with his injury record, you could.
No, I don't.
In our debate this week, we're going to talk about this incredible story about, I find it incredible, about Saido Berahino. A little bit of background for those who aren't Saido Berahino enthusiasts like I am. This is a guy, broke through a couple years ago, scored a ton of goals. Everybody loved him. He was at West Brom. This was summer 2015. It looked like he was going to join Spurs on deadline day, and then the hard negotiators went at it. He ended up staying put. And then he sort of disappeared for a while this season. And we all wondered, where did he go? And then he moves for not a lot of money because his contract is expiring to Stoke. And then it emerges that he received an 8-week ban, a secret ban, which reminds me of Animal House and being on double secret probation, an 8-week ban because he tested positive for a recreational drug. Matthew Sy joins us as well because, Matthew, you wrote about him. I want to start with the principle of, because this is where I have a problem. I don't have a problem with your employer banning you if you test positive for recreational drugs, because presumably it's written in your contract. I slightly have a problem with a league or an entity banning you. Before we get into the anonymity issue, if you're a lawyer and you test positive for drugs, you might get banned by Mishkan Dureya or whoever you work for, but you're not going to get temporarily disbarred by whatever professional association of lawyers is out there.
Some professional bodies may well have in the code of conduct that you're not allowed to break the law or bring the professional body into disrepute. It wouldn't surprise me at all if the Society of Lawyers have rules in the code of conduct for lawyers that bar the taking of recreational drugs. I wouldn't be surprised if that was true of doctors and other professional bodies. I mean, I think I kind of get the distinction you're driving at, but I don't think it's terribly relevant here.
I'm surprised that you're shocked that the FA has a say in this. If you're taking a substance that messes with your head, you're a danger to your opponent. You can't play in a league. You can't play football if your head's not right because you're taking a crazy substance. It's perfectly logical to say you can't play. Sorry, if you're taking ecstasy or cocaine, you can't play.
Well, first of all, it's not like the effects last 8 weeks. I don't think he was banned because he played under the
influence. Well, he wouldn't be allowed to.
Well, that's fine, but I mean the same way. Like you don't ban players for getting drunk, and that messes with your head as well, right?
I mean, it's against the law. I think the interesting debate is on anonymity, not whether the FA or the club is the right body to introduce a sanction. I mean, I wouldn't be at all surprised if the FA did it with the blessing of the clubs, that the clubs agree with this. But remember, the FA is an association of the clubs in the same way that the Premier League is an association of the top clubs. So, I mean, for me, the really tricky moral question is anonymity. I'm quite sympathetic to this in the sense that if somebody's got, as Alison said, if they're taking a substance that's messing with their head, if they're addicted, if there are real deep-seated problems at play, and not always, but sometimes this is the case, and we know about the Sporting Chance Clinic, which has a very large client base of top footballers and other athletes who have become addicted to various substances. So I kind of, a priori, are quite sympathetic to the idea of an anonymous ban so that they can come to terms with it without the... But Gab, in your introduction, you rightly pointed out that the problem is, if it's a confidential ban, it means that virtually any player who isn't appearing for the first team might fall under the cloud of suspicion. And moreover, as in this case, a player can pretend to be mystified that they're not playing, confident that the ban won't be leaked, and actually act in a duplicitous way. Which is exactly what he did, and then it was then it was leaked by one of the clubs just before they played the team that he's now in. So I think that the FA were acting for the right reasons and in the right way when they thought up the idea of a confidential ban. My hunch is, frankly, that the unintended consequences are so obvious that perhaps it would be better to explain to the public that the ban is in play and then ask the media to, I mean, it might be an unrealistic request, but to give the particular player in question some space so that they can go away and deal with the issue.
Paul, I want to get you on this because obviously you cover the Northwest Beat, which gets a tremendous amount of attention. This was Saido Berahino, so this is West Brom, and, you know, he's not necessarily a superstar yet, and his disappearance could be chalked up to Pulis didn't like him and whatever else. If this were Zlatan and he went away for 8 weeks, there's no way that they'd be able to preserve anonymity because too many people would know, right?
Yeah, we'd be asking questions left, right and centre. And, you know, it would come out. I don't think there's any question about that. It's a difficult one, isn't it? I get what Matthew's saying in terms of if Berahino does have a genuine problem, anonymity would have helped him in his rehabilitation. But at the same time, a part of me thinks, you know, he could just be hiding behind it. You know, he's so embarrassed by this that they're just trying to hush it up. I think at the end of the day, he's committed an error. I know the role model argument gets ruled out quite a lot. Part of me does think that the FA should have announced this. They announced all the suspensions as well. And I just think he may have just been too ashamed by it for it to come out. And, you know, he's a responsible adult. He's not, okay, if he was, 15, 16, he shouldn't be put in the public arena, no doubt. But he's 22, 23. He has been called up to the England squad before. He's played for the England under-21s. You should be responsible enough to take the flak that comes your way if you do transgress like this.
We should also point out now that we don't know if Saido Berahino has a drug problem or an addiction. We simply know that he tested positive at least once. That's all that we know. Matthew, I want to ask you from an ethical perspective or business perspective, everybody's been at pains to point out that Stoke were made aware of this fact when they bought him. Again, I wonder how that plays into the anonymity argument, because you can see why they should be made aware as opposed to just being caveat emptor. But by the same token, if that deal had fallen through, that would have done him no favours with his anonymity either.
So I think obviously the club that is purchasing has a right to know if a ban is in play for the player that they're going to buy. So I think that's absolutely right, that they should have been told. I sort of am sympathetic to the idea that I think Mark Hughes raised. Was it before or after the game when he said that he felt that the league may have been at the selling club after the event? But then you can understand why the selling club felt angered that Berahino had described himself as mystified that he wasn't in the team. I think very few people come out of this well. And there are lots of complex issues at play. I mean, you're right about that. It is difficult. And I totally hear what Paul says as well, that this was an error of some kind. But you know, I've been down to that Sporting Chance clinic. I got to know Peter Kay very well, who was the figurehead, the late Peter Kay, who passed away tragically, who himself had been abused as a child, turned to alcohol and became an addict and died as a consequence, frankly. And I've met a lot of people who have been down there and have felt that they needed that space in order to come to terms with what are quite deep psychological ironies associated with celebrity, fame and money at a very young age. And often young people who become top footballers, I'm not saying this is an excuse, but merely describing a phenomenon that undoubtedly exists, where they really do struggle with what it's all about, and drugs are a way of escape. And I do think that it's important that we understand that in the context of this. Berahino may be a completely different example, maybe fully okay with his celebrity and took it as a one-off and is not in any way addicted to drugs. I hope that is the case. But I can sort of see what the FA were trying to do with the rule that they brought in. But as I think we are sort of agreeing, the unintended consequences means that it's probably not going to be able to survive as a rule going forward.
Well, thanks to Matthew there. Cass, I want to get your take on this, because obviously had some ups and downs as well, as we all have. Should somebody who takes recreational drugs be banned from a sport, or should it be a matter for his employer, saying, like, you know, you broke the rules of your contract, the terms of your employment, we will get you help?
Yeah, of course you need help. He's had a gap year. He's had a year off. Yeah, and we're talking about his 8-week ban. He's had a year off, Saido. He's hardly played a game. He had fallouts with, quite clearly, the chairman, Jeremy Peace. I would think probably inevitably Tony Pulis, because he didn't select him. And he's got to look at himself, because Saido hasn't played football for a long time. I looked this morning. He hadn't scored a goal since February last year. You know,
still this better is, than Umani, yes.
You know, so you've got to say, Saido, what you're doing off the field is affecting you, not just for the 8 weeks, it's affected you for a whole year and maybe even longer. So he has to take responsibility and accept a ban.
I want to jump into
have a ban
on this, though. But a ban from the club or a ban from the FA?
I think the club should ban him for a while and seek help for him and try and realise that, you know, what he's got in front of him, he can affect his whole life by making daft decisions. If you're only going to go short bans on these type of things, Gab, you're only allowing more players to think, I might only get 8 weeks if I do something wrong.
Berahino didn't apply himself properly. He didn't commit himself properly to West Brom on the pitch, in training. And obviously now we've found out that in his social life, he didn't look after himself properly in that respect either. So he's got to, you know, smarten himself up really in every department. He is 22, so he's got a good 10 years at least left in his career. But you think about what he might be at this stage already had he actually applied himself properly. He'd be, you know, he could have 20 England caps by now.
Okay, enough Berahino and drugs. How about some quick hits instead? Tottenham are second after beating Middlesbrough 1-0. But Alison, it was rather hard work, wasn't it? How confident are you in them as the main challengers for Chelsea?
Well, it feels as though this is Spurs' blip. And if this is their blip, they're coming out of it rather well. And they've got some relatively easy games coming up. And I think you say it was hard work, but really you look at the performance and you think it was classy enough. It's fine. There are no problems there.
More likely to finish top four, Spurs or Liverpool?
Today, Spurs.
Can I go back to that one, that little instant poll?
I'm a bit cross today.
I know, so I won't bring up the fact that we had a poll about whether...
I wasn't as cross then.
Liverpool to win the Premier League or United to finish top four. Gabriel Jesus is the new striking sensation at City as his late goal gives them a 2-1 win over Swansea. Paul, does this mean the old striking sensation, Sergio Aguero, could be packing his bags in the summer? Or are you not reading that much into his quotes?
I think he was very frank about it, wasn't he, after the match, Aguero? He said the club will decide if I have a place or not. And, you know, given how important he has been for City over the last few years, it's quite a sea change, really. And it's all come down to the fact that Jesus has started incredibly well. Two starts, he's one goal and one assist, and he's had a massive impact.
Yeah, I think we're kind of getting carried away here a little bit. Gabriel Jesus is not a center forward and has never really played center. I mean, he's still young, but he doesn't play in that position. And I think Pep must realize that. And if you're Aguero, what else are you supposed to say? Like, I'll give everything I have. And then if the manager doesn't want me to start, then maybe they'll sell me elsewhere, right? I mean, it's a lot of money to carry on the bench. Manchester United pummel Leicester 3-0 and Mkhitaryan shines. Go, Mickey, you're so fine. Cass, would you rather praise Mourinho's tactical switch away from a 4-4-2 or talk about Valencia and his crossing as you did in your excellent column? Or both?
Well, I'll touch on a bit of both. I felt that for first 30 minutes against Leicester, I didn't think United offered too much offensively. And I do think that Zlatan sometimes needs support with that. Valencia, who I really like, I just think is an absolute... He just does that wing-back job brilliantly and he fizzes the ball across the face of the goal so often, where most people are looking to chip out or chip it at the far post, get it to people or to go attack. He comes on and fizzes it, and I think he does that better than anybody in the league.
See, I find your man crush on Valencia curious because I know where it comes from. Obviously, as centre-forward, you're like full-backs who could cross the ball back well, but I would have thought you'd prefer those hanging crosses that you could attack rather than those that sort of fizz across the goal mouth. You could have scored on both, I suppose.
Yeah, but I'm not playing anymore, so it don't matter, does it?
Good point. Speaking of Leicester, relegation draws nearer. Alisson, Kasper Schmeichel seems angry. There's all sorts of rumours about unrest in the dressing room. What's your take, and how likely is it that they will be the first champions to be relegated in nearly 70 years, which is older than Ranieri?
Yeah, I don't think it will happen that they'll get relegated. I think what will happen is they will have a surprisingly good performance against Seville in the Champions League, and that will give them a boost of self-confidence. There is a fundamental problem at the club, which is Ranieri was so laissez-faire last season and allowed their momentum to grow organically that there isn't a relationship there for him to sort of impose his philosophy on the team, and it's probably a little lax. But I think good game Champions League, people like Schmeichel getting really, really angry, it'll just do enough to save them.
So basically, Ranieri can't all of a sudden go and be bad cop. He can't put on his Archie Knox mask.
It's hard to see how that works when he's not done it before.
Romelu Lukaku scores 4 goals as Everton obliterate Bournemouth. Paul, are we too quick to point out Lukaku's flaws, and should we just appreciate him for what he is, the Premier League's top goal scorer?
Yeah, the way he took his goals on Saturday was particularly impressive. Sometimes I think he's carrying that team on his own, but he seems to bring other players into it. The Barkley started to improve recently as well. You look at United and who they might replace Ibrahimovic within a couple of years, and I know Jose's not a massive fan of Lukaku, but he would seem to be the perfect replacement.
In a couple of years, judging by his track record, Jose might not be there. Yeah. He might move on after winning his third Champions League. I'm going to hold my hand up because I was one of those people who thought that Big Sam was the right man for Palace. I still believe that. I still hope I'm right. But now doubt is seeping in, especially after seeing them get absolutely destroyed by Sunderland. Cass, do you want to blame Allardyce or praise Moisey?
Well, he tried to do a lot in the transfer window in January this year, which he did in the previous year with Sunderland that kept them up. Now, Scott Dan keeps going off injured, and Delaney's playing nowhere near the level he was before. He played punching in front of the back four, which didn't really fit for me.
Pardew did that too. Why, how does this guy keep getting a game?
Well, Jason Puncher used to be a centre forward.
It's like the Andrew Sermon principle. Like, you don't understand what I feel like I'm missing something. Maybe if I watched them more in person, I would see more. But what are these?
I don't know what you see in Jason Puncher, but he's bought the boy from Olympiacos, hasn't he? So he probably will fit him as a six and play in front of the back four. But Sam's got changes to make because they were out the game very quickly against Sunderland. And I think it surprised everybody in the game.
Are you part of Sam's army? Are you a believer?
I'm not sure. I'm not one of them type of people that thinks just because what's happened before, it's going to be inevitable that he keeps them up. I don't think it's as blatant as that. I think as we stand today, it's a coin flip whether Palace stay up.
Maybe the players are good and he's more clever than maybe 50. He's in the top 50% of managers in the Premier League in terms
I'd
of intelligence.
I'd be worried because not only defensively they conceded goals, Wilfred Saha's performances have dropped alarmingly since Sam's gone there.
Jesus, Saha and Townsend.
Ugh. Gab, I have a question for you.
Yes, thank you.
Cameroon are champions of Africa.
Yes, and yet,
they weren't tipped to win it. So what happened?
No, this is a phenomenal, phenomenal underdog tale. I would have loved to have written about it in my column on Monday instead. I had to write about stupid stuff like Monaco and Nice. But it's a great story because basically they were seventh favorites going into this competition out of 16 teams. Start with the manager, Hugo Bruce, former Belgian player, but you know he's managed a lot of Diddy teams over the years. And he sees an ad on the internet for the Cameroon job. So he sends his CV. And then he follows up with phone calls. And then, like, the Cameroonian FA are kind of like, wait, who is this weirdo? Because, you know, yeah, we advertise a job, but we don't really expect people to send in, you know, managers don't get hired that way anymore. But he busts balls so much, nobody else wants a job, that he gets the interview. The local media, not impressed at all. Then he calls his preliminary squad for the competition. And, of course, as everybody knows, 7 senior players turn it down. Including Joel Matip and Alan Neom. Now, some of these guys, obviously Matip apparently said he was retired or whatever, but all of a sudden, certainly the way they read about it in Cameroon is like, look, actually these people don't like you. They don't want to play for you. You're a fool. And then he goes into this tournament. And then the few veteran players he has, like Nicolas Nkulu, Clinton Jay, who of course was at Spurs last year, they get hurt in the group stage, in the knockout phases. They've basically had one guy who plays for a team in one of the big 5 European leagues. One guy in the starting 11. And that's Mukanjo, who plays for Lorient, who are, by the way, dead last in France right now. It's amazing. And yet they go, they beat Senegal on penalties. They beat your buddy Avram Grant's Ghana in the semifinal. And in the final against Egypt, who, you know,
are favorites.
Favorites, clearly more gifted, perhaps the outstanding player of the tournament in Mohamed Salah. They go behind, and you expect Egypt, you know, so smart, so tactical, blah, blah, blah. They've won it 7 times. You expect them just to ride it out. Instead, they come back. This guy, Abu Bakar, who plays for Besiktas, comes in, scores a tremendous goal at the end, you know, flicking the ball up over the defender's head and then shooting on goal and against a 44-year-old goalkeeper, Mohamed El Hadari. That would have been another great story. And they're champions of Africa. I mean, I think this is a really, really uplifting, underdog story, which shows...
You've explained what happened, but how did that happen?
So those players who would have been starters anyway, like they have this guy Basil Gog, who plays in Norway or one of those Scandinavian countries, they felt let down by the fact that these other players didn't bother joining them. And they really stepped up several levels. I think the weight of expectations was off them at every step down into the group stage. It kind of felt like, all right, well, let's just not embarrass ourselves. Okay, well, we got this far. Let's just, you know, there's nobody expects anything from us. Senegal will probably destroy us. Let's just go and be tough and be defensive and pick our spots. And they did that. I don't think Hugo Bruce is some kind of tactical genius, but it's also difficult to tell because, frankly, most of these players, we don't know them. We don't know I don't know them. I watch a lot of football, but it was tremendous. I mean, I think, you know, this is not dissimilar to Greece in 2004.
Was that longer than 30 seconds?
Slightly.
It was a much better story. You're talking some nonsense about Sam Allardyce. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. You search The Times online. Really not that difficult to do. You can also subscribe to our podcast. In fact, you should subscribe to our podcast. In fact, maybe you've already subscribed to our podcast. You can do so wherever you choose to download your podcast. Also, leave us a review on iTunes, only if it's nice, if you happen to be listening on an Apple device. We have people who meticulously read all the reviews and provide feedback. I'm not going to be around next week because I'm going skiing, but Alison Rudd will be here and she'll be taking great care of you.
It's all downhill.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.